You're listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. February 12th would have been the 209th birthday of Abraham Lincoln. And as we are the land of Lincoln, over the holidays, we thought we'd rebroadcast our hour-long program that we did to celebrate him. To begin with, did you know that across the country, there are at least 150 people who've made it their job to dress up as Abraham Lincoln for presentations at schools, libraries, churches, and on stage? At least 15 of those Abraham Lincoln presenters are in Illinois, and we spoke with two of them. Kevin Wood is a Lincoln presenter from Oak Park, and John O'Connor's on the line with us from Springfield, where his day job, I should point out, is the State House reporter for the Associated Press. Kevin, John, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Nyla. Thank you for having us.
So whenever I meet someone who has an interesting job, and I certainly think being an Abraham Lincoln presenter falls into this category, I wonder how they got their start. And I wonder for both of you, Kevin, if you want to start, when was the day you realized I could be Abraham Lincoln?
That day came, I suppose, when I was about 35 years old. This was about 16, 17 years ago. And I was doing an internship at my church in Philadelphia. And that meant that once a month I preached, and February came around, and I'd always had an interest in Lincoln, and especially I was interested in learning more about his religious beliefs, because there's contradictory statements about that. So I did research, and I actually presented Abraham Lincoln for the first time in my church, and that's what began it all. I should say, however, my interest in Lincoln actually goes back further. I went to high school in Metamora in Woodford County near Peoria. And Metamora is one of the stops when Lincoln used to ride the circuit. And the Metamora Courthouse is one of only two remaining courthouses that Lincoln practiced law in. And it's a state historical site. So that was my introduction to Abraham Lincoln way back in high school.
Ah, okay. John, what about you?
The day that I realized I could be Abraham Lincoln came about 6 weeks after it was first suggested to me. I am an amateur actor, do a lot of theater in the Springfield area, and Carrie Catton, who runs the theater at Lincoln's New Salem near Petersburg, north of Springfield, was familiar with a script called Mr. Lincoln by Herbert Mitgang, who just died a few years ago at age 94. He was a longtime correspondent for the New York Times. And she thought that I would do a good job in performing this one-man show. And when it was presented to me, it seemed far-fetched. It seemed ludicrous. And Kevin and other presenters probably have struggled with this sometimes, too. You know, how do I, you know, a mere mortal, portray this man who is mystical and whose language was transcendent and all those things? And beyond that, there was the problem that I am only 6'1", 3 inches shorter than the great emancipator, but
only 6'1".
I don't have the type of problem that other presenters, you know, I know that the presenters who are out there among the crowds need to have that height. When I'm alone on stage, there's nobody else on stage, so you can't tell that I'm a little short.
So you all do different things. John, you're talking about your work in acting. Kevin, you do a lot of work in schools and church groups. But both of you have used the term presenter instead of, I think people like a layperson such as myself would call you a Lincoln impersonator. Kevin, why don't you like to use that term?
Many of the Lincolns avoid that term, I think, just because it just doesn't seem quite dignified enough for Abraham Lincoln. Elvis has impersonators. Abraham Lincoln has portrayers or presenters.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, because you all, and I imagine for both of you, John, I imagine this is the case for you too, even if you're acting, both of you find yourself in roles where, for you, I'm sure the history of this and being historically accurate is something that's really important to both of you. John, is that the case?
Yes, the person that I work with, the director, producer, everything but actor, is named Carly Shank, and the dramaturg, she, in her research and preparing the first time we did the show, talked to several presenters, and we decided that we needed to, for example, with the costume, we had to be very, very accurate. You know, for example, I have a beaver hat from a hat maker in Gettysburg, believe it or not, because the presenters she talked to said, people know what's accurate, what's period, what's not. And one presenter said, if I don't have time to press my wool pants and I wear polyester, boy, they let me have it. So,
Kevin, what about you? Where do you get the clothes? Where do you get the clothes to be Abraham Lincoln?
The clothes generally come from what are called sutlers. Back in the day, in the Civil War, sutlers were the people that kind of followed the army around and provided uniforms and boots and such things. And so today, you can actually go to Civil War reenactment, and there are sutlers there. But some of them have year-round business, and so most of my items, well, they come from a variety of providers of sutlers. And my hat is also a beaver hat, and actually is from Canada. I would say also, it is important to have the costume right. I recall wearing one's pants with a zipper. You don't see the zipper, but you can tell from the kind of pants that there's a zipper on them. And so I was called out.
And people pointed it out to you.
Yes.
Oh, so people do too. And it's interesting because I think it's interesting that both of you all, people point these things out to you, because I wonder if people think they know about Abraham Lincoln than they actually do know. Has that ever been the case that people have presented, sort of people maybe have inaccurate information about him that you all have to correct?
Yes, definitely.
Go ahead, Kevin. Yeah.
I'd say both about him and about his times. So there are times when I do a program, and I have a fairly good resemblance to Mr. Lincoln. And afterwards, I'll have the comment, and you sound just like him, too. And, of course, my immediate thought is, you mean based on the sound recordings of Lincoln's voice, which, of course, don't exist.
Right.
That wasn't invented till about a decade later. So, yes, people have wrong ideas sometimes about him, about the ideas, about the time he lived in.
I'm a Lincolnphile and know maybe a little bit more than an average person about Lincoln, but it was funny the first few times I did this show, we would do a talk back afterward, and people would ask me very in-depth questions about Lincoln, very, very well-informed, and this is the Springfield area, too, so that's to be expected. But I remember saying, in one time I was asked, who's greater, Washington or Lincoln? And I responded, I'm sorry, I thought you understood I'm an actor, not anything else. I have learned from my audiences, too, but I've also have been interested in Lincoln from early on in my life and have done more research as I've portrayed him.
We're speaking with two Lincoln presenters. That's John O'Connor. Kevin Wood is on the line with us as well. We're talking about their other jobs being Abraham Lincoln, whether Kevin is talking about going before groups of school children or church groups, John talking about being a Lincoln presenter primarily through the one-man scripted show Mr. Lincoln. And can I just go back, John, and can I ask you this, especially because you're on the stage, we don't know what he sounded like, but we think we know what he sounded like. How do you figure out how to sound when you're playing Abraham Lincoln?
As you suggest, We have indications they had a high-pitched voice. It carried well over crowds, large crowds and distances. We know that he was born in Kentucky. When I first started experimenting with the voice, it was kind of a cross between Bill Clinton and Forrest Gump.
okay.
And sometimes, so it's kind of I kind of try to get a little high-pitched with a little drawl to it. And Carly Shank suggested that a good way to interpret that voice would be to end some sentences with an inflection that goes up, as if you're asking a question.
John, you're also an actor, and you, as we've been talking about, one of the roles I'm very curious about is you played John Wilkes Booth. What is it like to be someone who's played both Abraham Lincoln and John Wilkes Booth?
It's interesting, and I've tried to reconcile it, and I can't. I've played other, I've played Judas, and I've never played Jesus, but I played Judas.
Was it easier in a way to wrap your head around playing Judas than it was to play John Wilkes?
Yes, because there's a sympathy that you can have for Judas. You know, the idea that he was destined, you know, someone had to portray Christ. You can't find that with Booth. An elementary school teacher said to me one time, I've never forgot it, this was about fourth grade, in talking about this situation, she said, John Wilkes Booth killed the best friend the South had. And it's true. Without, you know, the South would have been much better off under Lincoln, you know, with malice toward none, rather than the radical Republicans who took over and set up Reconstruction. And that led to, you know, suppression of the South and Jim Crow and all kinds of horrible things. And this was all set in motion because Lincoln couldn't finish his term.
Mm. Kevin, you actually have played multilingual Abe Lincolns, primarily in Spanish, although you've also done presentations in French and German. What is that like? Does that make Lincoln more accessible to audiences when maybe people hear his words in their native language?
Yes, I believe so. It's obviously not authentic. Abraham Lincoln, as far as we know, didn't speak Spanish. He would have known a little bit of German because the German vote was very important. He actually owned a partial ownership of a German newspaper in the day. But Spanish, he would not have known. But since I happen to be fluent in Spanish, I find that it's a wonderful way to reach out into communities and actually speak to native Spanish speakers in their heart language.
Mm. And Kevin, I understand you also have a daughter who's a student at the University of Illinois. There have been times when you've showed up at her dorm dressed as Lincoln. How did that go?
Well, yes, I've done that. I have two other daughters at the University of Chicago. In fact, I was just there the other day eating in the dining hall dressed as Abraham Lincoln. And, of course, it attracts a lot of attention from the other students, from the staff. And so I get lots of questions, lots of requests for selfies and photos. And it's generally a good time.
Do either of you guys ever, I feel like in every 5K or marathon, there's always someone dressed as Lincoln in Illinois. Have either of you guys ever done that?
That's one of my, the other sort of non-authentic Lincoln thing I do is I run races
Kevin,
dressed as
that's your
Abraham,
okay.
I run races dressed as Abraham Lincoln, yes.
John, you've never done that?
No, and I can say it's not on my bucket list either. But in Springfield, it seems like there are multiple 5Ks and 10Ks that have Lincoln's name tied to them.
Yeah, there's a ton of those. Do people ever ask you to step out of character? How do you handle that, Kevin?
I often get asked, and I imagine John does too, questions that related to modern times. You know, it's kind of difficult to answer those. The Lincolns have different ways of going about it. Some of them stay in character always. I'm one who always stays in character. And others will step out of character in order to address, you know, kind of what would Lincoln think about such a thing. You know, I won't answer the question, you know, what do I think of Donald J. Trump? But I will perhaps address the question of immigration. Immigration was a big issue in Lincoln's day, and it's obviously a big issue in our day. So I can kind of indirectly speak to issues.
So, John, I feel like I can't let you go without asking. You're a State House reporter. We're talking to you right now from the State House. You're a political journalist by day. I wonder what kind of interplay there is between your day job covering day-to-day politics in Springfield and then your other work as an actor portraying President Lincoln, you know, a century and a half before.
You know, another role I played is in the musical 1776. I played Edward Rutledge, who is portrayed in that musical as the South Carolinian who ensured that slavery remained part of, was not, you know, prohibited in the Declaration of Independence. And people asked me that then, what were the, and I could say I could understand the idea of states' rights, that, you know, the federal government don't lean on me, and the idea that we have sovereign states in this nation. With Lincoln, we know that the era of big government really began under Lincoln. And so it's kind of the same thing. You think about some of the federal rules and restrictions we have today, and what I deal with in the State House is a lot of times state lawmakers say, now we're forced to do this by the feds. The other thing, one time an audience member said, you're a political reporter. If you had an opportunity to ask Lincoln a question, what would it be? And without hesitating, I said, how can you justify suspending habeas corpus, which, you know, allowed dissenters in the Civil War to be held without seeing a judge and having, you know, a cause to be held, that the state would have to prove why we're holding this person? That's the one, you know, the one thing that is kind of paradoxical about Lincoln. We think of him in terms of freedom and liberty and America, and that is one contradiction.
Yeah. Kevin, do you think there are lessons to be learned from Lincoln's time? I just think, especially as someone who is so intimately connected with his life, that you think are especially relevant for us today?
Yes, there are certainly lessons, but I think the greatest lessons just come from the man himself, from his strength of character, from his compassion, from his honesty, from his vision for the country to be something better than it was and something perhaps better than the direction it was going. We need to remember that in 1857-58, the direction the country was headed was a country where slavery might be allowed in the entire nation. And he and others wanted to fight against that, fight against the extension of slavery into the West, and into the North, and with the hope that one day we would be a nation entirely rid of slavery, even if it might not happen in their lifetime, at least put us on the road to that end. And so I think we can still certainly learn from that and adopt some lessons from him.
That's Kevin Wood. I want to thank him on the line with us from the Chicago land area from Oak Park. I want to thank also John O'Connor from Springfield, actually from inside the State House. Kevin, John, two of the, you know, more than a dozen Abraham Lincoln presenters in Illinois, giving us some insight into what it's like to be an Abraham Lincoln presenter. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Niall.
I'm Niall Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. Stay tuned to hear more of this encore edition of the show. Coming up, we'll have more stories and news from across Illinois. Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Niall Boodoo. We're revisiting our hour-long show from President Abraham Lincoln's birthday this past February 12th. We were just hearing from two people who dress up and do presentations of Abraham Lincoln. And now we're going to hear from two more people who've taken it to the next level. Max and Donna Daniels joined us from their home in Wheaton, and they're a real-life husband and wife team that do reenactments together as Abraham Lincoln and Mary Todd Lincoln. Max, Donna, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Well, thank you for inviting us.
Thank you.
I feel like I have to, sometimes you have to start with the obvious question, which is you all are married in real life. You portray a very famous married couple. So I have to ask, how did you meet? Was it while you were both portraying Abraham Lincoln and Mary Todd Lincoln?
I'll let you handle that, Mother.
No, we actually met each other before we began portraying the Lincolns, but we met when we were both members of a community theater group here in the suburbs of Chicago. And we were in a play called The Rainmaker. He was playing File, I was playing Lizzie. And at the end of the play, File ends up with Lizzie. And in the course of the production, Max and I started seeing each other. And I always tell people we met very cute, you know, very theater cute. And then a couple of years later, after we got married, is when, well, we were still involved in theater, and he answered an audition notice for a children's play that needed an Abraham Lincoln to come in at the end and save the day. And at the time, it was just the next role he was going to play, but someone who saw him in the play approached him and asked him to come to be in an historical pageant, and that led to a parade and a number of other things. So we actually got our start both as a couple and as the Lincolns because of our involvement in a community theater group.
Mm. And so earlier in the hour, we were talking to two other Lincoln presenters. It sounds like, Max, did you have the idea first? And then, Donna, then did you decide if he's going to be Abraham, maybe I could be Mary Todd?
Actually, about the fifth or sixth thing he got invited to, someone finally asked, oh, and could your wife come as Mary? And we just showed up originally, we borrowed costumes from our theater group to show up and look like them. And that was all we intended to do. But then when we discovered that when you do that, people will start asking you questions. And we thought maybe we'd better brush up on this a little bit.
And are you all members of, I know there's the Abraham Lincoln presenting, I'm trying to remember the name of the Abraham Lincoln Association. Are you all official members?
Association of Lincoln Presenters.
Ah, sorry. That's it. The Association of Lincoln Presenters. Both of you are members of that?
Mm-hmm.
And do people ever ask, when you all are presenting Abe and Mary Todd, do they ask you, are you guys married in real life? Does anyone ever wonder?
Only constantly. Yes. And I usually answer, you know, are we married? And they say yes. And I said, you mean to each other? And they go, yes. And I said, yes. As a matter of fact, we are married and to each other. So,
And do you all, because I know we were actually just talking about this as well, do you, when you are Abraham and Mary Todd, do you ever break character when you're doing that? So if they ask, are you married, do you just assume, oh, they mean we're married because we're pairing Abe and Abe Lincoln and Mary Todd Lincoln? Or do you guys break character and say, yes, and when we're not wearing these costumes, we're also married?
The question usually comes up, you know, we always do a question and answer period after our performances. And that's when it usually comes up. And usually by that time, we're kind of, we could answer either way, depending on who they're asking the question of. If they're asking the Lincolns a question, we answer as the Lincolns. And if they're asking about Max and Donna, then we answer as Max and Donna.
In a few minutes, we're going to be speaking with a food historian, and I've been reading this book, Abraham Lincoln in the Kitchen, and actually the really interesting thing about it was how much I learned about Abraham Lincoln and Mary Todd Lincoln's the relationship as a husband and wife, and sort of how much their deep love for each other, and I've learned a lot about their relationship, how he liked to cook with her in the kitchen. How much did you, Max, I wonder, how much did you know about their relationship as a husband and wife before you started doing this?
Not much. I was born in L.A., as I tell people, which is Lower Alabama. And I knew very little about the Lincolns at all. But the more I have learned about the Lincolns, the more I am just in awe of not only Abraham, but of Mary and the great relationship that they had as a couple. I think Mary does not get treated fairly in history. Until recently, but the more I've studied Lincoln, the more I'm amazed that the man was able to hold her, you know, to shoulder the load that he did during the Civil War. So my admiration for Mr. Lincoln has certainly went up 100-fold since I started studying him.
Donna, what about you? What about what are your sort of observations about their marriage and their relationship as a couple?
Well, we're sometimes asked, you know, did they love each other? And we always answer yes. They would have had to stay together through all of the tragedies and the challenges that they faced together. As Max said, Mary tends to get sort of caricatured. And
well, I think, and I think everyone thinks of, like, the way that she was, I'm thinking particular recent history of the Lincoln movie, and she's sort of portrayed as having a lot of mental health issues or being mm-hmm. really hard on Abraham Lincoln. I feel like that's kind of maybe an image people might have of her.
Yeah, unfortunately, you say Mary Lincoln's name, and the first thing people think about is, oh, yeah, she's the one who was crazy. But there were so many other things about her. And she had good aspects of her character, too. She made mistakes like everyone does. But I think people tend to focus on the unstable parts, and they don't give enough thought to how much she loved her husband. She was devoted to her husband and her children, and how much she actually helped him advance in politics. I sometimes get accused, or she gets accused, of pushing him into running for political offices that he had no desire for himself, just in order to satisfy her own stunted political ambitions. And I tell people, he was already involved in politics before she met him. But if he was going to go very far, then he needed a partner exactly like Mary Todd, because she had grown up in a very well-to-do family. She was very cultured. She knew how to brush up his manners and make sure he dressed properly and knew how to make small talk with people. I think she was very instrumental in helping him to advance his political career.
Right. And I think it's an interesting observation about their life together as a couple and how she helped him in his political career. Max, Donna, can I ask, where do you all do you mostly do Civil War reenactments? Where do you all take part in playing the roles of Abraham and Mary?
Oh, my goodness. Everywhere that we're invited, I suppose, would be the answer. Libraries, conventions, reenactments. It's almost endless. We have been invited to portray the Lincolns at venues that you wouldn't even think of as being places to perform. But
like where?
A large percentage of our clients are schools and libraries. Ever since the presidential Museum opened up down in Springfield, we've also been getting a lot of calls from tour groups that come into the city. So we're fairly familiar with the city of Springfield by this time. We come down there a lot and do programs for tour groups. We've done quite a lot in the Bloomington area and Peoria. And we say we travel the Midwest. We have about a 5 or 6 state area that we've gone to over the past 30 years or so. A lot of Civil War reenactments in the summertime. Obviously, February is a busy time for us at schools for Lincoln's birthday, but we also visit schools in the springtime when they're teaching the Civil War and when they're getting ready to come to Springfield for a class trip and things like that.
What's your favorite part of doing the work, Donna?
I like being able to rehabilitate Mary's image because she's gotten such a bad rep over the years. I love to hear people come up to me afterwards and say, oh my gosh, I never knew all that about her. You know, I've never really liked her, but I never knew all that happened to her. No wonder, you know, she went a little around the bend. I would have too. So I like to be able to show her as not the stereotype crazy woman, you know, to show the other good sides of her character as well.
And I understand both of you now, you've sort of made it part of your mission to offer a helping hand to the next generation of Abraham Lincoln presenters.
Yes, we're big believers in paying it forward. And when we were starting out some almost 30 years ago, people helped us, people who were more established Lincoln presenters, and we got to meet some recognized scholars, and they sort of mentored us. They gave us advice and, you know, sent some work our way that they could have easily taken themselves. And so now at this point in our career, we believe that it's our responsibility to do the same for someone else.
So you all have been doing this for 30 years. I forgot to ask, how many years have you all been married?
32.
Wow. Okay. So 32 years you all have been married. Well, thank you so much for joining us. President and Mrs. Lincoln in real life, Max and Donna Daniels. To learn more about their work, you can also visit their website, which is abeinthebabe.com. Max, Donna, thank you for being with us and happy Valentine's Day.
Well, thank you.
Same to you.
Have a good day.
When images of Abraham Lincoln come to mind, the idea of him wearing an apron and in the kitchen may not be one of them, but we know that's actually historically accurate. As a child, he may well have pounded corn into meal and made hominy. As a young man, he cooked on trips along the Mississippi River. Even as a married man, he still helped out in the kitchen and maybe even made his own supper. That's a picture painted by food historian Ray Amy. She's written about him. Her book is called Abraham Lincoln in the Kitchen, A Culinary View of Lincoln's Life and Times. She's on the line with us from Iowa. Hi, Ray. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi. Glad to be here.
So what do we know about what life was like during Lincoln's time in terms of how you put together this book? Because you have authentic recipes that are updated for the modern kitchen, but then you have really great vignettes based on history about the food of the time. Where did you draw upon to sort of find out resources of what kind of things Abraham Lincoln ate, whether it was a child or as an adult?
Well, a lot of good resources are available, both in letters that were written about him after he died. His law partner, William Herndon, wrote letters to everybody he could think of and could find. And so they provided a lot of anecdotes and specific information about what Lincoln ate as a child and as a young man. You have letters then that Mary Lincoln wrote where she describes a little bit about the food. And then looking at the newspapers from Springfield, the old Springfield newspapers were chock full of what was available in the stores, what was happening in the marketplace. And then looking at the specific cookbook that we know Mary Lincoln had, which was one of Miss Leslie's, who was sort of the Martha Stewart of the time, very popular American writer who lived in Philadelphia, and her cookbook spread across the East Coast and then into the developing part of the country. And Springfield was a very sophisticated city in the 1840s, 50s, 60s, when the Lincolns lived there, built their, you know, remodeled their house there 3 times, and, you know, became a real power couple. And the other part of how I got to the food was I cooked it. I looked at the recipes, I looked in other old cookbooks, and just kind of dove in and started to see what would happen in the kitchen.
So let's talk about for a minute before we get to their childhoods, because Mary Todd Lincoln had a very different upbringing than Abraham Lincoln did. I want to just go back to what you said about Springfield at the time, because I was surprised to look at this, that, you know, there were things, people were growing things like hot red peppers, fennel, coriander, peppermint, sage. These were all very common things that people used at the time in terms of flavoring their food. What else? I mean, as you're describing, there was a lot of sophistication and flavor in the way people were cooking, especially when Mary Todd Lincoln and Abraham Lincoln, when they were a married couple in Springfield. What kind of ingredients did people use at the time?
Well, you have the, you know, the common ingredients, you know, chickens and hogs and beef, of course, but you also have food in cans, which were, you know, coming from the more urban centered areas. You know, there's pineapple advertised in the newspaper, pineapple in cans, prepared tomato sauce, and tomatoes were just beginning to become a popular accepted vegetable. Back in the colonial era, they were sort of thought of as being poisonous, incorrectly. And then you see, you know, oysters, for heaven's sakes, which would come in barrels alive, and you could have the barrel by your back porch and sort of keep putting water in to keep them alive. And they also came in cans, and it was just fascinating to look at the newspaper ads. The oysters were very popular in December, you know, for the holiday season. And when they first come in, all the ads are saying, oysters, yes, 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 with exclamation points and with a set price. And then as you got, you know, a few weeks down the road, the prices kept going down. So it was, you know, we need to get these off the shelves. But then you have all the bounty that's coming in from the nearby farms, you know, to the market, which was, you know, not that far from Lincoln's home. So it's really, you know, kind of a crossroads both of bounty locally and then from, you know, the Caribbean and from the, you know, the Atlantic coast states and from the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah, and so I do think it's interesting what the things that we talk about when we talk about sort of nowadays, we talk about farm to table and eating seasonally. These are things that Abraham
right.
Lincoln did as a child out of necessity.
You know, the Indiana farm life where Lincoln lived with his parents from his childhood until the whole family moved to Illinois when he was 21 in 1830, that farm, too, also changed. At the very beginning, they hacked it out of the wilderness, but over the years, it, too, became a successful trading community. So they began to be able to buy things like sugar and as opposed to having to rely on honey and sorghum, which they would have grown.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Ray Amy. She's a food historian. She's the author of Abraham Lincoln in the Kitchen, A Culinary View of Lincoln's Life and Times. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning into The 21st. Today we're talking all things Abraham Lincoln. We have been talking to Lincoln presenters. We have been talking to a husband and wife team that play Mary Todd Lincoln and Abraham Lincoln. And now my guest is Ray Amy. She's a food historian. We're talking about food during Lincoln's time. The president is someone, President Lincoln actually did like to cook. Ray, how do you know that he liked to cook? We have lots of, there is actually, you found when your research, there is evidence of that.
Indeed, there is. The research that really got me involved and excited about the project was a letter that one of his neighbors wrote describing his mother helping in Lincoln's kitchen and that Abe would come in, put on his blue apron, and help Mary cook. And that just opened my eyes to all of the possibilities. And then the more research I did, the more I discovered that he cooked as a young man, as you said earlier, going down the Mississippi River. He probably helped cook when he and his troops were tromping around northwestern Illinois during the Black Hawk War. But, you know, here he is in the kitchen in Springfield after going to fetch the cow home from the community grazing pasture, and he'd bring the cow home and milk the cow and come in and help Mary cook. And I think that's what I found really compelling, is the way the love story between the two of them can be told in their interaction with food.
And before we get to, I think when people, if people think about that, they think of Mary Todd Lincoln's courting cake. That's maybe the one recipe everyone knows. Before we get to that, what, how did he learn? They had very different upbringings, Mary Todd Lincoln did and Abraham Lincoln. What did he learn as a child, the type of food? It was interesting to me how much, it shouldn't be a surprise that everyone grew corn, but that was a big staple of his diet first as a child in Indiana, and then when they moved to Illinois. What did he? What kind of food and what kind of environment did he grow up in, having to prepare and cook his own food?
Well, he and his stepmother, of course, came along when he was 12. You're living in a rustic cabin where essentially the open hearth is the center of the heart and of the home, so you can't not learn how to cook because it's right there whenever you walk through the main room of the house. So, you know, they're eating simpler foods. They're eating, you know, foods, as we were saying earlier, you know, that they would have grown. So you're looking at things like, you know, beef and pork and corn in a whole variety of ways. But, you know, as you were suggesting earlier, Mary's upbringing was very, very different. She grew up in a sophisticated community of Lexington, Kentucky, in a slaveholding family. So her experience in the kitchen was almost non-existent. There's one anecdote where she talks about being in the kitchen when she was driving the cook crazy. So, you know, just by her antics. But when she and Lincoln married, they moved into essentially the house, which is still the President Lincoln's house in Springfield. But when they moved in, it was a very small house. They remodeled it into the two-story thing that we see now. And she had to cook in the same kind of kitchen setup, the open hearth, that Abe grew up in. And yes, she had the help of a family member, one of Abe's relatives, but here is this woman who loves sophisticated clothing, whose sister is married to the son of the former governor, Ninian Edwards, that's Elizabeth, and she's right there doing what she can to make her husband happy and successful.
So let's talk about them when they were in the courting cake and the almond cake that maybe people have heard about as a recipe. It's actually a cake that I've tried to make. I tried to make this a couple of years ago just as an experiment. Can you tell us about the story of this cake, first of all, before we get into the actual recipe of it?
Well, this cake is one, as you said, that sort of is the legendary one. And there are a couple of recipes floating out on the web, and they have baking powder in them. And there's no way that can be the authentic 1840s cake because baking powder didn't exist. So I went farther back and found one that I think is more reliable. I found two. One is the one that I call the courting cake, which is sort of like an angel food cake. It has very little flour in it, and what supports it is the way you beat the eggs. Both that and the almond pound cake, which is easier to make, because it's more like a pound cake, require using almonds that are pulverized into very small bits. And when you pulverize them, either with a food processor, which is what I do, or you can actually pound them in a mortar and pestle, you release that almond flavor, and you really get a very, very fine cake. It's easier to make now. You don't have to allow 2 days, which is what Miss Leslie said we should do, a whole day to prepare the almonds. But Lincoln has been said to say that that was the best cake he ever ate. There are those who say he said that about everything.
Because he was a kind man. Can I ask you about period ingredients? Like you said, baking powder didn't exist. There are ingredients you use here, things like pearl ash that you say were period-specific ingredients. Can you tell us about pearl ash and sort of the different things that people used then instead of sort of the modern things that we know now in our kitchen?
Well, you've raised the key ingredient that has really shifted, the key important ingredient that has shifted through history, and that's how do you make something rise? How do you make a biscuit light? And that leavening ingredient back in the 18th century were essentially non-existent. You cut in butter to give you layers, or you whipped egg whites, or you used yeast, and those were the three ways you could make something light. Pearl ash comes along, and it really is ash from trees that is cooked and baked and refined to get a white layer, a white powder. That then gets further processed over time into something that becomes a purchasable ingredient, which is called saleratus, which then becomes baking soda as people, chemists and people selling things to people refine it. Then as you get up into the Lincoln era, you have both baking soda and cream of tartar. Those two ingredients are then combined to make what is baking powder today. So there's this continuum of chemical ingredients that go from pearl ash to baking powder. And so you can date a recipe if you don't have a really good source within a bracketed range by what it gives as the leavening ingredient.
And how did you figure out, it must have taken a bit of detective work to figure out all of this?
Well, it's reading a lot of cookbooks and reading a lot of recipes and reading some technical journals and then, other work that other historians have done to kind of begin to understand what's what.
And then there's also interesting, like archaeologists have done excavations, particularly around the Springfield home in the Lincoln home in Springfield. They found clues to what the family also ate. What kind of things did they find?
Well, they found, as we mentioned earlier, the oyster shells. So we know that there were oysters that were part of the kitchen garbage that went into a well that was covered over when they put the extension on the house. So it remained this perfect little time capsule. And you could see the kind of beef bones that were still in there. There was peach pit. So you get a sense of the kinds of foods that the Lincolns ate by what they threw away, which is, certainly a common and well-established way to, kind of get right down in there and see what people did eat.
What kind of influence did people have at the time? You write about Portuguese, Irish, German. We were talking about Springfield being sort of a cosmopolitan place at the time.
It's hard to know exactly, who influenced the Lincoln kitchen. We know that Mrs. Lincoln certainly interacted with the various people in the community who came to help the more wealthy homeowners. There were seamstresses and cooks. There were Maria Vance, who was a woman of color who helped in the kitchen. There's stories of a Portuguese seamstress and how much they interacted and how much their foodways exchanged. I really don't know, except the sense of it that I have is that both Abraham and Mary were interested people. And so they would certainly welcome interacting with people all across the community of Springfield.
Ray, now that we maybe have people's appetites, maybe they're getting a little hungry with us talking about all this food. I wonder what recipes you wanted to share with everybody. Period recipes that were things that the Lincolns made, especially when they were entertaining in Springfield. We didn't really even get to what they made, what kind of food they ate when they were at the White House, but let's just kind of focus on the Springfield time. What's a good recipe that people could make now that is still true to what they would have made in the 1850s?
Let me give you one that's really easy to give over the radio because it's not a baked thing. It's a strawberry ice cream, and it's one that we know that they made strawberry ice cream because in the grocery ledgers there are strawberries, there is cream, and then there's this notation, salt for ice cream. So we know that at the end of June that they were making strawberry ice cream. And this strawberry ice cream is very different from what we normally get because it's almost equal parts berries and juice and cream. So you get sort of a cross when you bite into it between like an Italian ice and then this creamy note to it.
So more like a fruit. Yeah, it's more like almost like a smoothie than ice cream, maybe.
Well, no, it freezes up. It freezes up, but as you eat it, the impact in your mouth is both creamy and crystalline. It's really good stuff. So you need 4 cups of sliced strawberries, and you could use frozen ones, 1/2 cup of sugar, more or less to taste, 2 cups of cream, 1 cup of milk. If you're using the fresh berries, you cut them up, chop them pretty well, and then mix them with the sugar to draw out the juices. Then you combine the strawberries and the cream and the milk and freeze it according to your freezer's directions. Or if you don't have an ice cream freezer, you can just put it in your freezer in a metal bowl and stir it every once in a while, and you'll get ice cream.
And that's exactly how they did it. They had ice cream makers.
They did have ice cream They did have ice cream makers.
Obviously, not the ones like what we have today, but right. Ones that require lots of hand cranking and salt.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. Hence the need for salt to mix with the ice to lower the freezing temperature. And if people want to go to my blog, which is rayskitchen.net, and Ray is spelled R-A-E, rayskitchen.net. There are a couple of other recipes that are up on it.
Yeah, you've shared some great ones. We'll tweet that link out. I want to thank Ray Amy. Her book is called Abraham Lincoln in the Kitchen, A Culinary View of Lincoln's Life and Times. She just mentioned her blog where she's got a couple more things. We'll tweet all of that out if you follow 21ST Show. Ray, thanks for being with me.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it very much.
We thought we'd end today with some special Lincoln music. Have a great day. That's all the time we have for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, and every other way to contact us. If you want to send us an email, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, if you'd like to figure out all of our social media handles, you can just remember our website. That's 21stshow.org. Speaking of social media, if you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on. You can see the things we're reading. You can post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're broadcasting today from the Medill Graduate School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.